Hey everybody, happy Friday. Welcome to another, I say happy Friday because this is the newsletter and you're getting this in your newsletter and that's Friday. So happy Friday. Welcome to another episode of the OIG Roundtable. Whole team is here today. Super excited to talk about today's topic. As always, love to introduce my partners in crime, Wade McFall, retired assistant special agent in charge from HHS OIG and a member of our SIU investigative team, Matt Kachansky and Jason Eisengrind, retired SAC level, special agent in charge level from HHS OIG. Matt retired then from the Northeast UPIC and is a manager here on our SIU investigative team. And Jason, Matt's counterpart, who was the UPIC West director and retired and is now our special director in charge working on special projects and deliveries for some of our SIU clients. And I am Eric Rubenstein, senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse here. So today we want to talk about, a topic. There have been a bunch of press releases. I think, we want to kind of come back. We've been talking a lot over the past several months, really, about SIU process improvement and the like. And I just want to loop back and talk a little bit about things from kind of the OIG, the UPIC, CMS operational perspective. One of the things that we bring to the table here at Advise is we bring a side of the investigative process that that is kind of unique, right? Having people like myself, Wade, Matt, Jason, and others who are retired OIG people, agents and people who worked in the investigative world, the criminal, civil, administrative, and particularly Matt and Jason, who were UPIC directors. The UPICs are the SIU for Medicare. And for those that don't know, there are five UPICs and there's the Medic. The UPICs are parts A for hospital insurance, part B, which is medical, and durable medical equipment, and the Medic does Medicare Advantage in Part D. And there's often this crossover, particularly on the Part A, B, and the D side, where the Medic and the UPICs need to work a little bit more symbiotically. And so, the past couple of weeks, there have been a number of press releases on pleas, convictions, and the like for some very large dollar amounts. And, we work in this pay and chase environment. And so we want to kind of talk a little bit about some of that backstory about the general question of why. Why meaning, why is the fraud perpetuated? Why is it that providers get away with it? Why is it that the dollar amounts are so large? And there's two cases that recently were in the press releases over the past couple of weeks. One was one of the defendants from the Operation Brace Yourself cases, which was over $1 billion in DME fraud out of South Carolina, was just sentenced. And a provider in a podiatry case involving the foot bath schemes was found guilty or sentenced after about a $4 million fraud out of, I believe it was Nashville. And we've blogged, we've talked, we've podcasted, we've pontificated about these schemes exactly. We've talked a lot about the telemedicine fraud schemes, the brace yourself stuff. We've talked a lot about the foot baths. There have been a lot of things. I had a podcast that I did with Gary Ciccio, a well-known podiatrist in this space, on these foot bath schemes. They were very common schemes. But the question that always is begged out there is, why is it that frauds that we look at from a Monday morning quarterback perspective continue to appear to be perpetuated? And the question is always, why isn't it stopped? And why is it, that it continues on? And why aren't the UPICs doing more about it? Why isn't the OIG doing more about it? And there is there's a lot of backstory behind a lot of those reasons. So, Jason, I want to start with you because we were talking about this yesterday, you and I, and the genetic testing piece came up, right? So you've got these big frauds going out there right now. Telemedicine becomes kind of the tip of the spear on these, right? Because the telemedicine is what ultimately leads to a lot of the mail order pharmacy, mail order diabetic testing, mail order genetic testing, mail order DME, all of that. It comes down to these telemedicine, which we really are calling telefraud, because there is no interaction. There's pieces of the puzzle that are missing that when we look at it from the investigative perspective, see that those pieces are missing. But, one of the things that we were talking about yesterday, Jay, was the fact that where you were as the UPIC West director, you saw a fairly large amount of fraud in the genetic testing when other UPICs in the country weren't really working as many of those cases. It was really a lot of it was going on in the Western region. And there were a lot of reasons behind that, right? And it's not 100%, it's not that the UPIC West wasn't doing its job or trying to do its job. It's not that Matt at the Northeast UPIC was doing a better job than you at the West UPIC. It really has to do with some of the underlying policies that exist and how the MACs are the ones that create those edits, right?
Absolutely true. Just two quick things. First off, is and it's definitely relevant to the point that I'm going to make, is that the UPICs, in addition to the Medicare portion of its responsibility, it was also Medicaid. And the reason why that's important is that prior, the ZPICs, the previous version of a UPIC, had just a small insertion into Medicaid. And CMS, and you know, wanted to really get to a concept called one PI, one program integrity. And the idea is lessening the cooks in the kitchen. So, you know, for instance, when Matt and I got in the game so many years ago, decades ago, I hate to bring you down to that level, Matt, but there were 62 claims payers in the United States. And, you know, in a place like New York, where Eric and I were working, there were two claims payers, one in, for Queens and one for the other four boroughs. And they had no idea what each other was doing and what they were seeing. There was absolutely no coordination. And then over the many years, you saw CMS refining that process to, you know, where they created DMERCs and other mitigations to too many cooks in the kitchen. And so the UPICs are the latest iteration of that, and the Medic for that matter. Now, the other point is that, is it, Eric said that about part of our responsibility on these podcasts is to pontificate. Do you, can you imagine that these retired thuses and suches from UPICs and OIG are pontificating? Anyway, if the shoe fits, wear it. So point is that CMS, doing its due diligence of the UPICs performance, they noted, you know, they had the ability, obviously, to look across all five UPICs, and they could see, well, the UPIC West was not slamming in the genetic testing world. And there are 25 million Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries in the UPIC West, one of the larger jurisdictions, frankly. So how is that possible? And frankly, the company I work for, and still an excellent on embedded quality control. So we took that as a customer concern. We did a root cause analysis. And what we found was, in fact, that, well, the MACs that, that serviced the UPIC West had LCDs and edits in place that helped mitigate that concern. So it was a good thing. And, you know, just further proof of that was that, you know, when we looked at the few that we did, the few concerns of genetic testing in the jurisdiction that we could find, the reality was that they were snowbirds or whatever else in Arizona, that their claims were actually being paid by MACs outside of the jurisdiction. So they didn't have the LCDs and edits and therefore, you know, slipped by. So bottom line is, my recommendation to the SIU community is work with your claims payers. You know, start to develop a strategy. Everyone wants to talk about predictive analytics and artificial intelligence, and it all has a place in this. But the reality is there are some good old-fashioned tools that can be put into place, like the communication with your claims payers, to start to stop the problem, you know, at a much earlier stage.
Yeah. So, you know, the one thing that we don't want to have a long kind of dissertation discussion about is NCDs and LCDs, national coverage decisions, local coverage determinations, the effect of law. You know, there's a lot of back and forth. LCDs don't have the effect of law, but then they do. Depends on the administration, things that are what they call sub-regulatory guidance and things of that sort, where is it really a law? Is it not law? Is an LCD just a guide to follow? So we don't want to get into those details. But the important piece of that is that, you know, as Jason's bringing up, is that, you know, claims are paid based upon where the Medicare beneficiary's, you know, home of residence is. And so those claims get processed based upon where they're, you know, where they are and where they're going and things of that sort. And so you could have an instance in which, you know, a claim that would be rejected by one MAC is paid by another just due to the fact of that divergence. And the one great example I give is I worked on a case many, many years ago where the provider had an office in Trenton, New Jersey, and they had an office in Morrisville, Pennsylvania. For those that don't know that geography, the Delaware River is what separates them. The guy's offices were 3 miles away from each other, two different Macs. In one jurisdiction, the service that he was rendering was had a policy. In another jurisdiction, it didn't. And so how do you, you know, he was committing fraud either way, but the difference is that you've got the extra steps that you have to make to be able to prove that fraud, because there isn't a policy that was in place. So there's that divergence that exists. So Matt, I want to go to you, because that becomes from a investigative perspective, whether it's an SIU, whether it's the OIG, that becomes a challenge about whether you're going to treat something as an overpayment, as a prepay, as a postpay, as a referral to an SIU or to the OIG or to a Mufuku. But the collateral effects of, you know, when we get back to kind of the heart of what we're talking about, is how is it that the billion-dollar DME fraud is able to occur? How is it that these footbath schemes are able to occur? A lot of that is from the investigative perspective. It's the data matching. It's the ability to understand the divergence in policy. And then when you get to something where you have covered drugs, like in Part D, and, you know, the footbaths are one of the things that they almost make you laugh, because the medications that are at issue here are medications that are not water soluble. It's like taking a scoop of peanut butter, putting it into a bowl of cold water and trying to see how it's going to melt and do all these things. If these aren't water soluble medications, you know, how do they even work? But, you know, you have this issue of FDA-approved medications, right? CMS's general position of access to care, access to quality care, lack of restrictions and things of that sort. But it really does present itself with both investigational and then process issues to deal with.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, we look at healthcare differently than CMS does, obviously. They're trying to strike a balance between access to care, provider abrasion, keeping the providers happy, keeping the beneficiaries happy. And we're looking at it from, this is wrong, we need to stop it right now. But there are other considerations that CMS takes into account that, you know, where they try to strike a balance. Do they strike that balance every time? Probably not. And I always look to their COOP plan. Their COOP plan, which is continuing operations, if CMS blows up because of a bomb or whatever, priority number one, checks keep going out to the providers. That's their number one priority. And it always will be, because they need to keep those providers happy. So, you know, when we're working with them, we have to take these things into consideration when we, you know, we don't set policy as a UPIC. We recommend things such as with DME, you know, these billion-dollar DME frauds where there's no history of the patient with the provider that's ordering this equipment. You know, why can't we just have an edit in the system that stops those? Well, CMS, in doing their balance, has a rationale of it. The providers are allowed a year to submit a claim for a service. So it could be that the DME company submitted their claim before the doctor did, so they have to pay it. 95% of the time, that might not be true, but that they're going on the trust factor of, we have to trust that these are true until proven false.
And that's an important point, Matt, is the fact that there's a 12-month delay. Now, for those of you that have been around a long time, you'll remember that it used to be 18 months. And after 12 months, you had a reduced payment. And I want to continue on this, but, you know, I had a case once involving it was a podiatry case where the podiatrist intentionally submitted his claims after 12 months, knowing that he was getting a reduced payment, but his fraud was so pervasive that he was under the impression that by doing that, he would reduce his potential of being caught. And this came right from the lady that was doing his billing, that he did that intentionally, because you had that period of time. So, you know, yeah, that's a great point, is that 12-month period of time, is CMS's way of saying, hey, you know, and the DME companies, we all know this, it's a race to the finish line. In the diabetic testing supplies world, it's at midnight on day 31, you know, day one, it's to get that in. And that presents a whole other set of unique problems, right? Because by the time that data catches up, the DME provider could submit a claim like literally day one. And, you know, I don't know of many providers who are going to wait 12 months to submit a claim because they want to, obviously it's a accounts receivable issue, but you know, there is that prospect. You have 12 months to submit a claim. And so if CMS is directing MACs to deny a claim because there isn't a matching E&M, the argument is going to be, hey, the fact that we are processing, you know, we're submitting our DME claims in a timely manner, don't punish us.
Right. That's right. And then, you know, you also have the fact that, excuse me, that like Jason was talking about with these labs and the genetic testing, you know, a lot of our labs on the East Coast were being used as reference labs for his labs. They were sending the samples to us to run and bill for them because we didn't have the LCDs in place that would have edited those claims. And again, it's based on in that the local political situation of that MAC trying to appease their providers and based on who their providers are. And they are very autonomous in making those decisions. And even CMS really can't do anything about that.
Yeah. Jason, do you have some follow-up on this?
Yeah. I just, so another fallout from not stopping the problem early is that a defense strategy, and I've seen this in a trial, was that, well, if the government was paying this, it must have been good. And so, like, you know, and especially when it's a difference between jurisdictions or whatever else. And so for, you know, 12 people in a jury box, it, you know, does that create a reasonable doubt? It could. And in fact, I think it did have an impact, frankly, because one of the defendants ended up being acquitted. And that's very rare in federal trials. So it's just another thing to keep in mind.
And that's especially true when, you know, the government knows what's going on and continues to allow the fraud to happen because right. They don't want to, maybe they're planning a covert operation or whatever, but they're allowing the fraud to continue even though they know it's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, that becomes a huge challenge from an investigative perspective is the divergence of policies from MAC to MAC and the fact that a claim, you know, I think really, you know, part of this argument is that a claim that is what they call a clean claim, right? So CMS has what's known as the clean claims rule. And the general premise of the clean claims rule is that a claim is considered a clean claim when it is free of errors or omissions. And so the fact that a claim gets paid by the program doesn't mean that it is not a false claim, even though it is paid, right? We see billions of dollars going out that are ultimately tainted by some underlying fraud. And the question is, why did it get paid? Well, under the clean claims rule, if all the T's are crossed, all the I's are dotted, and there's nothing within that claim that triggers a rejection, you know, maybe a mismatch of a piece of technical information, like a date of birth or a beneficiary name or something like that, or a mismatch from NCCI edits or MUE edits, that claim is considered a clean claim, but it doesn't mean that it's not a false claim, right? There are two different pieces of that. So Wade, I want to go to you as we kind of wrap up, because part of this is, you know, Jason loves to say all fraud is local. And this really does get to the heart of showing that fraud is local, because, you know, what we know from our investigative cases and the things that we've done is that the fraudsters will oftentimes move and shift and create operational business things relative to where in the country they can be, right? We see DME companies, for example, or mail order, whatever it may be, close here, reopen here, and that there's that constant shift. And so while fraud may be local, part of the important metric is understanding what are the different MACs, what are the different LCDs out there, because you want to make sure that there's some consistency. But a big part of it, and you know, I think this is where we get to a little bit of talking about that law enforcement liaison work, is that having that inherent connection to the community and having that inherent connection nationally. So what Wade McFall is seeing in LA is Eric Rubenstein seeing it in New Jersey and New York, or vice versa.
Yeah, and I think an important part of that is with the OIG, because we have offices, had offices in every state, multiple offices in many states. So if there was something happening in New York that was affecting LA, it was easier for us to kind of, uncover that and address it, as opposed to where you're talking about these different SIUs, which are just, each one is like an island. They don't have any crossover with other states or, you know, so you realistically have, you know, 50 different entities that can't really talk to each other and don't. So having something like the law enforcement liaison could help with that, especially if the different SIUs from different states all had them, and it could be like almost like a MCC meeting with the liaison folks, to kind of get out there the types of schemes that you're seeing, the trends, that type of thing. So again, I think having that nationwide kind of coverage makes all the difference in the world, as opposed to all these individual non-connected entities, really.
Yeah, I mean, and Jason kind of alluded to it in New York. You know, New York was unique because for many, many years, four of the five boroughs in the city were covered by one MAC. At the time, it was the carrier, right, and the fiscal intermediaries, and then became the MACs. And so you had four of the boroughs were one payer, and Queens was another payer, and they didn't have consistent policies. And that created havoc, because you could have an instance in which a provider had an office in Queens and had an office in Manhattan and was committing the same fraud, but it was treated differently whether you were in Queens and Manhattan. And the one great example I give is the very first trial I had involved a 20 defendant podiatry RICO type organization called Jamaica Foot Care. And they had offices in a number of the boroughs. They had an office in Queens, and most of the providers had been terminated from, it was at the time, GHI, but they had not been terminated by Empire Medicare Services, which had been in the other office, which was the other four boroughs. And so what would happen is patients would go to the Queens office, get treated, and they would submit the claims to Empire as if the service was being rendered in Manhattan. Two reasons. One, they were not terminated from Empire. And two, there was actually a higher reimbursement in Manhattan versus the other boroughs. Now, it was nominal. It was a couple of dollars. But when you're churning out claims, it becomes, you know, it becomes volume work. So, you know, a lot of times I think the problem is that the OIG gets beaten up for not doing this or not doing that. And a lot of times it's not the OIG that's at fault. It's because of this, you know, kind of broken system that we generally have in this pay and chase world. We're not like a lot of other countries where it's one payer, it's a national payer who have their own set of problems, right? But, you know, we're a unique world because it's pay and chase. And I think that, you know, what you guys have all brought to light on these things, it's, you know, why is it that the foot bath scheme continues to go on? Well, you know, in part, it's because Medicare is there to provide medically necessary items, services, and procedures to its beneficiary population. Medicaid is there as that safety net as well. So, you know, do you put so many limitations on the plan that if someone actually needed one or more of those ingredients, right? Because at the end of the day, for example, in the foot bath schemes, does the program, when it's paying for these individual ingredients, necessarily know that the podiatrist is telling the patient, put these ridiculously useless medications into a bowl of water and sit four times a day? Probably not, right? They're seen as individual medications. And so when the program sees them coming in, is the program know that these are foot baths versus, you know, a topical that you're rubbing in, you know, on the catheters, does the program know that these patients don't really know the catheters when you get back to Matt's premise of the referring doctor has 12 months to submit their E&M? So, it becomes a real bunch of different pieces of the puzzle. You know, then you throw in NCDs and LCDs, and then you throw in these arguments of clinical medical necessity to, you know, to kind of get to it. So, Jason, as we wrap up, I want to give you the last say on this, because we did pick on your former UPIC a little bit as not being the heart of the problem. And so I want to give you the last word on some of this from your thought.
Just an interesting factoid, and it's relevant to the points that we've been making here today. And it was specific to the city so nice, they've named it twice, New York, New York. So in addition to the multiple claims payers, in addition to any other, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen theory, so New York is unique in that there are two different federal judicial districts within the same city. So Brooklyn and Queens is the Eastern District of New York, of course, Long Island as well. And then the Southern District, the other boroughs and up through the lower counties in New York State. So, you know, you throw that in, and where did the claims, where were they generated? What you know, bank did they pass through? It creates venue issues that get all very complicated. So again, to Eric's point that when people look at, well, why didn't this, you know, get prosecuted, or why did they settle, or whatever, there are so many other factors that complicate the situation. So I just thought that might provide some illumination.
Yeah, I mean, we could have a whole separate conversation about venue and how venue is established and the like. And, you know, for us in New York, Southern District and Eastern District, two huge districts. And that was something. If, you know, the thing that's interesting, just to close this out, but Empire Medicare Services, which was located in Westchester County in the Southern District, we oftentimes would bring cases that were where the provider was in Brooklyn, we would oftentimes bring those to Eastern District, even though there was venue in Southern District, because at the time the Eastern District was more aggressive in their prosecutions than Southern. And then when Southern District started to become more aggressive in their prosecutions, even though the provider might have been in Brooklyn because the claim was processed in Westchester, which was Southern District, we would bring the case to Southern District. So it is not uncommon, and no one should ever think that there's an issue involving ethics or morality or anything involving what is typically known as venue shopping. It happens all the time. We see it with QI-TAMs, where whistleblowers will bring a case to a particular judicial district that may be known for having, you know, very successful results in cases. Boston is a great example. They've led the country for many, many years in the pharmaceutical world when there were a lot of QI-TAMs being brought. The U.S. Attorney's Office in Boston was super aggressive on those cases. And if you're a whistleblower and you're a relator attorney, it's all about money. So you want to go to the districts that are going to get you the biggest bang for the buck. And so it is not uncommon to do that. So, you know, look, I think this is an ongoing topic, but I do think that when we see the press releases that come out and we see these large dollar amounts, there's always this knee-jerk reaction of who messed up to allow this to happen. And it doesn't mean that there wasn't a mess up. There likely was a mess up, right? Otherwise, these claims wouldn't have been processed. But, you know, I think it's just part of this global mechanism that we've got in the country, global meaning within the U.S., you know, as far as the global universe of how we do these things. And I think that is what ultimately precipitates where some of these issues may be. So I think we're gonna have some ongoing discussions about this. I know that when we're talking to our SIU clients, we talk a lot about bringing in the law enforcement liaison piece to help to stymie some of these variances that are there so that we really get to the heart of the matter. So ongoing conversations as always, but I'm glad we get to at least talk about some of these things. Again, we like to provide some of that backstory that people don't necessarily get to see from that OIG investigative perspective and from that UPIC managerial perspective. So I always appreciate the insight that you guys bring to the table. And as always, we appreciate people signing up for our newsletter, taking the time to watch our podcast and our LinkedIn lives and such. So again, if you're not getting our newsletter, feel free to send us an email at hello@advisehealth.com. We've got our April LinkedIn Live coming up. We're going to be talking about the case of U.S. v. Paulus. I've got a great group of people. I'm going to be moderating a discussion with Stephen Lee and Hillary LeCicero, two great lawyers who were on the defense team for Dr. Paulus. It's a fascinating case. I think the legal community is going to be very interested in hearing about what we're going to be talking about on this. So again, we thank you for participating in our newsletters, our LinkedIn lives, and being part of helping us with our fraud, waste, abuse, and compliance issues. So till the next time, we'll see you on the next OIG roundtable.
Thank you.
Thank you all.